Hi, this is Kat Cole, advisor, investor, and public speaker, and I've loved spending time on the Made for More podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of I'm Made for More podcast. It's your host, Enes, here. And today we have a very special guest. It's the one and only Kat Cole. She's the woman responsible for taking the famous restaurant chain Hooters, yes, Hooters, from 100 locations and $300 million in annual revenue to 500 locations in 33 countries and $1 billion in annual revenue. She then went on to become the president of Focus Brands, the parent company of seven notable brands such as Cinnabon, Auntie Anne's, Jamba, Carvel, Schlotzky's, McAllister's Deli, and Moe's Southwest Grill. In this interview, we get to hear how Kat grew up living on a food budget of $10 a week for 3 years to becoming the president of a 10,000 employee company. Kat and I will also discuss the four mindsets you need to master to become a successful leader, how to say no by actually saying yes, as well as how to manage your time more effectively. Now, without further ado, enjoy this powerful interview with the inspiring Kat Cole.
Kat, thank you for being on the show today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Yeah, pleasure is mine. So the first question that I like to ask is, if you could teach everyone in the world one topic or concept relating to either life or business, what concept would that be?
I think it would be the concept of what I call the four mindsets, and that is humility, curiosity, courage, and confidence, and the art of having command over those mindsets and learning when and how to use them in the best combination. And that typically results in a form of humble confidence, where there are times where humility is needed to be in the forefront and courage and confidence sort of in the background. And there are times that courage needs to be in the forefront. And many people have not learned first to be self-aware enough to even begin this process. And they then haven't learned some of the ways, even if it's not natural for them, that they can be humble, curious, courageous, or confident. And so I have found that the most successful humans in the world seem to have command over those mindsets or characteristics and have learned how to turn the dial on them up or down, depending on the situation.
At what point in your career did, that click for you and, you realize the importance of having a balance?
I, of course, in the early days, wasn't able to put it in a framework or call it a thing. That happened many, many years later as I reflected and paid attention to patterns. But in the early days, when I was opening restaurants around the world, I was 19 years old, I was 20 years old, and I was constantly in a new country with a new team, sometimes with a language I could barely speak or not at all, in an environment where, you know, business was run differently and the industry was a little different and the consumer was different. And that is an incredibly humbling experience when you live in your own country and your own world and you know things so well, and then you go somewhere else and you're expected to still do that very good job, but 50% of the things are different. And yet I still had to lead. So I think it was that experience of going places where I'd never been, expected to lead a team I've never met. That in and of itself requires humility, because there's much I don't know and much I need to learn, and curiosity, but I still have a job to do. And so it required a level of confidence that I could figure things out, and a level of courage to be there to begin with and to keep pushing forward. So those early days of opening restaurants around the world were probably when that was first most apparent.
Yeah, so inspiring. I think you were 19 years old when you got asked, and I definitely want to get into that. But before, I want to touch on your childhood. I know you grew up in Jacksonville, Florida. Your dad was a Vietnam War veteran and was the breadwinner in the family. And he actually had, what I found interesting was he was the, he actually had the best job from both sides of the family. But unfortunately, he was an alcoholic. And so at age 9, your mom decided to get a divorce. What was it like growing up, you know, with a single mom, and how were you able to make ends meet given that he was, you know, the breadwinner in the family?
Yeah. I mean, the reality is I didn't make ends meet. My mom did.
Yeah.
And, you know, she did what moms or any parent in that situation has to do. She worked multiple jobs. You know, it's like a business, right? You increase revenue as much as you can and you reduce expenses. And so we lived incredibly modestly. And she worked enough to pay the bills. And I think her food budget for us for 3 years was $10 a week. And she figured it out and we're fine. and so that is just it. Much like an entrepreneur or an individual navigating a tough circumstances, sounds like much like your parents, as you were saying, you just figure it out. And the reality is you can do a lot with very little. And my mom did a lot with very little, and we were grateful for it. And so that's how.
How do you live off $10 though a week? It was you. You're the oldest of
three girls,
right? Mm-hmm. So how do you live off of, you know, $10 a week?
Yeah, well, $10 a week isn't all she had. That was the food budget. So, but still, right? That's not a lot of money. And so, you know, there are a lot of things, at least back then, and even still today, cost under a dollar. You know, cans of beans. I remember eating what were called beanie weenies, these cans of beans with little hot dog slices in them. And if you think about it, that's lots of protein, tons of nutrients. I mean, we ate beanie weenies all the time. Sandwiches, bologna, you know, not the most healthful protein, but very cheap at the time. My mom figured out how to get scraps from the butcher. She just knew how to make a little go a long way. And it was pretty good, actually, you know, so that's how, right? I think your mindset changes when you realize there's only this much money. Like there are no options, right? There literally is only this much. And so you have to do two things. You have to make that stretch as far as you can and make sure we don't waste. But then you have to try to make more money. And so for 3 years, you know, that was the food budget because it was very difficult for her to make enough money to cover all the bills. We had no child support from my father. And so she had to pay rent. She had to pay utilities. She had to buy us clothes. You know, all the other money she was making from side jobs and her main job had to go to much larger living expenses. And you really can eat enough to survive and be healthy on very little. Now, was it ideal? No, I'm sure we have some nutrient deficiency somewhere because of it.
Don't we all, right?
Though? Yeah, but yeah. She figured it out.
Totally. What's your relationship like with your dad, if you don't mind me asking?
Pretty good. I mean, he, you know, we communicate pretty regularly on major holidays, life events. We're not spending a lot of physical time together. We live in completely different cities, but we check in. You know, I would say it's pleasant. I love him. He loves me. I know he's deeply regretful and remorseful of the decisions he made in his life. He's clean and sober now, which is wonderful. So yeah, it's, you know, it's nice. It's not the closest of any father-daughter relationship, and it's certainly not isolated and we're not speaking. You know, it's a little different for my sisters who are at very different places in their journey with the relationship with him and processing, you know, how everything went down, but you know, it's good. I'm grateful he's still on this planet. I'm so glad he's clean. I'm glad he's got family, his immediate family around him. He has another daughter that's not us three, a half sister we have that's very close with him. So he's good. You know, the reality is, given the direction he was headed, he could have been in a ditch somewhere. So the fact that he's clean and alive and just kicking it is a good thing. I'm very happy for him.
Happy for that, to hear that. What were you like as a kid? Were you like outgoing, a shy person? Were you a good student, one of the popular kids in school? What was it?
I think like I am now, I was what I would call now a multi-hyphenate, where I wasn't known as one thing in one group, You know, I wasn't the best of the athletes, but I was deeply embedded in athletics. And I wasn't the fastest or most talented tumbler or gymnast on the cheerleading team, but I was co-captain and then the captain. I was the captain of the debate team briefly in junior high. And then I was on track briefly, and I was the slowest runner on the track team. I was popular enough to sort of be in a lot of circles, but not the coolest kids that everybody wanted to hang out with. I was with the geeks and the nerds because of my classes and my desire to learn. I tutored and spent time with athletes. You know, I spent a lot of time in many what you would call typical groups in high school, very similar to what I do now. But the common thread is I took on leadership roles. I mean, since I was very young, I was the leader of this, the captain of this, the head of this, the person who took responsibility for things optionally or was elected or appointed, or I would raise my hand for things. So that was the common theme.
Okay, so fast forward to junior year in high school, right? I think you were 17 years old. You got a job at Hooters as a hostess, right? Why Hooters, and how did that job come about?
Well, Hooters was not a big deal in Jacksonville, Florida. I'd been there forever. It was the second city that a Hooters was ever in. So it was another restaurant, honestly. Like, people were used to it. It's where you went to get chicken wings. It's Florida. People wear little clothes all the time. It was funny to me as I grew up that it was weird, or it was a thing for people. It was super common there. It started in Florida. And it was a beach shack themed restaurant, and people would literally pull up their boats because it was right on the water and come have like wings and beer or crab legs and burger. It was just a normal restaurant. And one out of two people have their first job in a restaurant. So, you know, if you think about it that way, it's actually not a big deal. But it was also known that the waitresses at Hooters made more money than in tips than the average server at a TGI Fridays or an Outback or another casual dining restaurant. And so, for that reason, for someone who needed to pay my own bills as I was growing up, who needed to save up for college, why would I want to be a server in a restaurant and make half? You know, just, it doesn't make sense. And so I was recruited. I worked in a mall. Hooters was my third job. I started cleaning gym equipment when I was 15, I started working in malls when I was 15, selling clothes, or 16, selling clothes. And then I was recruited. Like, people would come in with a Hooters recruiter card, and they loved hiring people from retail and customer service because you already have those customer service skills. So I thought it was really cool that I was recruited into Hooters. And so at 17, I went in to apply, and 18 is how old you have to be to actually pour alcohol in the state of Florida. So I could only be a hostess. So I was hired as a hostess, which meant I was opening the doors, cleaning the bathrooms, cleaning the tables, seating guests, managing events if they happened at the restaurant. And then when I turned 18, I became a waitress.
Okay. So you did that for about 2 years till the age of 19, when you got asked to open franchises around the world. Is that right?
Well, 19 is when I got asked to open franchises all around the world. Yes. But I was still a waitress. So, you know, I would travel to go open restaurants, but that only happened every so often. And I still had to work in between. So I went to Australia. I opened that restaurant for 40 days. I came back. I'm a waitress, right? Or a cook, or running a shift, or a bartender. And then I went to Mexico to launch that location, was there for just under 40 days, came back, and I'm a waitress, right? So I'm still an hourly employee in all regards. But yes, that window of time when I was 18, I was a waitress. I started learning how to cook and picked up some kitchen shifts. I would be a bartender, you know, lots of different roles in the restaurant because I needed shifts and hours and money. And I loved working all the jobs in the restaurant. And then eventually was asked to be a part of the new store opening teams to travel around the world to open the first of the franchise in each of these countries. And in many cases, the first on the continent.
Wow. That's just fascinating to me. Looking back, what do you feel it was about you specifically that they saw in you to ask you to open up, franchises across the world at such a young age?
I mean, I would, you know, encourage people who are listening to think about, well, what would you need to think about someone to feel comfortable sending them to represent you in another country? Right? If your name is on them, what do you need to think about that person? And that's the answer to what it was about me. I was mature. I didn't let people down. I was willing to help. I knew my job incredibly well. I knew multiple jobs so I could fix or figure things out. And that's it. I mean, traveling to open new stores is not a novel thing. That's how concepts grow. You take employees from location one, and a few of them that are really good go train the new hires at location two. You take employees from location 10 and 100 and 120, and you send them to the first one overseas to go train new. Like, this has been done for decades. A lot of people don't know it, though, if they didn't work in restaurants. And they're like, oh, this sounds so amazing. You must be so amazing. Not really. Is this how retail grows? But I did have those characteristics. I was very good at my job. I worked multiple jobs in the restaurant. I was very mature for my age. I had already been training new hires in my own restaurant. I mean, that is what it takes to become a trainer for a new store. And those capabilities intersected with the company having a really high growth period.
Totally. Okay. So you're flying back and forth out of the country, opening up franchises, first in Australia, then I think it was in Central America, right? And what I found interesting was you actually took a pay cut when you made the transition from being a waitress to the corporate side of Hooters. I think you were making $45,000 a year as a waitress, and then you cut it down in half, more than half, you know, 22,000 in corporate. Why did you agree to take that pay cut, and take us through your mindset? Were you thinking long-term, like, hey, I'm going to get myself in the door and I'm going to work my way up, or what was it?
I mean, it wasn't that sophisticated. I think if I had realized how hard it would be to live off that much less, I might not have made the decision. It was just being naive. Like, I have always lived very simply. And so I didn't, and I've never been someone who worries about money, even, and maybe that's because I didn't have a lot of it. And so I just didn't worry about it. Again, a little foolishly. But it was more exciting to me to learn and take on a corporate role where I could be more impactful in the business. That was more exciting than my level of concern over the financial side. I mean, I didn't love it. I remember hearing the number and then comparing it to my previous tax return and thinking, you know, this is supposed to be a promotion. And I have to move and be in a city I've never been in. You know, there were concerns. I was bummed. I tried to negotiate a little higher. I think maybe I got an extra $1,000 or something. And they covered my moving expenses, of course. But I just didn't worry about it. Like, the excitement of the new role and getting into the corporate side of things was exciting enough. And then I realized, oh, you know, when you work as a waitress, you can just pick up a shift. Like, if you need money, it's almost always there. And that's not true when you're living off a paycheck, where you actually need to manage your money and make it spread out a little more. So I went through a little bit of a learning curve as a young corporate employee living on paychecks and not like working shifts and having cash around all the time.
Yeah. So, you know, a common theme that I'm hearing is, or message is, you credit a lot of your success to saying yes to opportunities before maybe you're even ready for it, right? When do you say no to an opportunity?
In the early days, I didn't say no to something unless I just didn't like it. You know, I said yes to everything if it sounded cool, or if it sounded fun, or if it sounded like I would learn. And if it didn't, if it was with people I didn't like, or if I just didn't have the availability, I would say no. But I said yes far more than I said no, because I didn't have many responsibilities. You know, I didn't have other people. I didn't have kids. I didn't have a husband. I didn't have people who relied on me for my time. I mean, the world was wide open to say yes to everything. And I'm so glad I did. And then as time went on, I had other responsibilities to larger teams in my personal life. And then I had to be more thoughtful about what are my values? Where do I want to spend my time? With whom do I want to spend my time? And am I protecting enough of that to live up to those values. And then that's a formula. I wrote a whole newsletter on how to say no. There are processes that you can use to figure out what to say no to. And then there are techniques that I share in this blog post about how, then once you want, know you want to say no, then how to say no.
Yeah. So how do you say no?
There are many ways, right? First, no is a complete sentence. No, no, thank you. Right? No, thank you. And then if people are stunned, it's like, I don't owe you any more than that. I typically do give more than that. But if I want to say no, thank you, someone says, would you like fries with that? No, thank you. I don't have to say why, right? Then the other way is to find a way to say no by saying yes. Yes, I'd love to help you, but I can't be the person. Let me introduce you to someone who I think would be a great fit. Or no, I can't give you the donation you're asking me for, but I work in a food company. I bet I could donate some food. Would that help? Right. And just it's, I'm saying yes to a different but related question, but I'm saying no to what I can't, shouldn't, or don't want to do. Another way to say no is, I love what you're doing, but that is not in line with my priorities at this time. And I cannot give it the energy it deserves.
I love that. Okay. So, I want to circle back on something you mentioned earlier, and that was, you know, around building trust with your teams over and over again, as you were traveling, around the world, right? How are you able to build trust with people, you know, of different backgrounds, different cultures, maybe even different religions? Yeah. How are you able to build trust with them?
First is being really humble. It's back to these four mindsets, right? Like telling my story as much as I felt comfortable telling, to let them know I'm not some boss who's here to just be a robot and make your schedule and get on to you, you know, if you don't do your job. I'm a person. I have a family. Here's how I got here. You know, just a little bit of sharing really does help humanize an individual and helps build relationships, and often, not always, but often encourages others to share. And so a relationship can form. So that's step one. Step two is using my actions, not just my words, to demonstrate that I'm there for them. So I'd get up early and get coffee and pastries, or if someone needed something, I would get it for them. Like, yes, I'm the leader. I know the plan. I know the schedule. I'm here to hire and, if needed, coach, counsel, or fire people, of course. But more importantly, my job is to make sure you do a really good job. And whatever you need to do a really good job, whether that's coffee or water or a pen, you know, or whatever, if I can do that, I'm going to help with that. And so, again, not just words, but actions that demonstrate I'm here for you. I'm not happening to you. I'm here for you. Is incredibly important. And so that service mindset. And then the third thing is having the courage and confidence to make decisions and lead. You know, no one wants to be on a team with a leader that can't make decisions. Even if it's a bad decision, at least people know what they're supposed to be doing. And that's the other way to build trust, is make decisions, be a clear communicator. If things aren't happening the way they should, address it, even if that means addressing a person. And learn and move on, just, and then repeat that cycle.
Yeah. Has there ever been a time you experienced where maybe you made the wrong decision, lost the trust of the employees, and how were you able to build that trust back?
Of course, no one makes right decisions all the time. But if you react quickly enough and acknowledge that, oh, my bad, you know, that wasn't the best thing to do, it doesn't typically cause you to lose trust. It's just not the end of the world. Like, people F up all the time. And so, you know, just the, oh, that was not the best idea, and let's do it differently, kind of prevents it from being the outcome being that trust is lost. Then the question is, do you have the humility to say that didn't work? And maybe I need to involve two of you in doing it better. And so showing that humility that, okay, I made a decision that didn't work. How am I going to make a better decision so it has a higher chance of working? And that possibly could involve collaborating or including more people. I mean, people respect someone who owns their part in an issue and moves on and does better.
For sure. Accountability as a leader is everything. Speaking of people and employees, you've probably hired hundreds, if not thousands of people at this point. Let's say you're hiring a candidate for a leadership position, right? Can you tell within a 10-minute interview if they have what it takes to, you know, be a great leader or not?
No. No way. I can tell, I can get a really good vibe for their personality. I can get a really good vibe for how that style, because I can cut through the surface, you know, even if someone's nervous, pretty quickly. I can tell how that might show up in the workplace. But tell whether they'll be a good leader in the first 10 minutes, no way. That it, anyone who says that is disrespecting the complexity that is being a great leader. I have met leaders who are very quiet and introverted and don't interview well at all. But seeing them in the role, their team loves them. They make the right decisions. And then I've seen people who are, you know, like Energizer bunnies and walk around with a virtual megaphone and their magnetism is tremendous, and who are also great leaders. And I've seen both of those types of personalities that are not great leaders. Like, you know, leadership is so, so many things. It shows up in so many ways. And, you know, the real way you know that someone is a great leader, you asked about great leaders. So that's a pretty high bar. I'd have a different answer if you said, how quickly can you tell that someone has the potential to be a good leader, right? That's a different question. Telling someone is a great leader requires time, seeing them in the role, seeing how they navigate complexity and challenges. It's easy to be good when times are good. It's easy to be great when times are good. It is tough times, unexpected times that reveal whether someone is great as a leader, and then also the effect they have on their people over time. What do people say years later? Are the people they're leading becoming leaders themselves? Even if they leave the company, do they attribute some of their development to that leader? Are they proud and grateful of their experience with that leader? You can't tell that in 10 minutes with a conversation with someone. You're looking for the potential.
Yeah. So how can you tell if someone has the potential?
Well, I certainly can't do that in 10 minutes.
Okay.
You know, by 10 minutes, I've barely even heard their personal story. That's why interviews are long. That's why big leadership positions are typically 8 interviews, 9, 10, 6 with 5 different people. Right? There's a reason that good interviewing processes are lengthy. And each of us are going to see something different in someone to then come together and discuss to what degree do we believe they have the potential to be a great leader. But there's basics, right? Empathy. Do they display a history? Can they describe a history of empathy? Really back to the 4 mindsets. To what degree can they give me examples of them being humble? To what degree can I tell they will be curious? To what degree can they evidence displaying confidence in uncertain situations? And how have they demonstrated personal and leadership courage? I mean, those are the things that I'm looking for, and having someone say it is different than them giving examples.
Mm-hmm. So Kat, one of the final questions I have for you is, you know, until about 3 weeks ago, you know, you were the president of a 10,000 plus employee company, Focus Brands. You serve as a board member at multiple companies. You're a speaker, you know, you're a mom. Basically everyone wants your time. How do you manage your time so effectively?
I think it's energy management more than it is time management. You know, one is I try to make good decisions on what is the highest and best use of my time. I certainly have things, a list of things that I must do that are priorities in the calendar. And that includes time with my kids and time with my husband and my board meetings and working on my book. Like, I have things that just block the calendar. And then there's a whole lot of other things like this conversation that are nice to do. And I could do tons of those and don't have the time to do tons of those. So I try to have it be a mix of One, what is the likelihood that this time spent is going to be the most impactful, which has to do with audience reach, impact, and connection. And then trying to mix in someone who's early in their journey and, you know, having a conversation and being like, yeah, I'll make an hour for that. I can't make an hour for everybody who's starting a podcast or for everybody who's doing things, but once in a while I can. And I really enjoy that. And, you know, everybody deserves honor and respect and appreciation. And certainly if I can find time to weave in a mix of folks who are earlier in their journey versus those that are already, you know, more visible or more impactful, I try to do that once in a while.
Well, there you have it, guys. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you did, please take a minute and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. I'd love to see your feedback there. And for more inspiration, be sure to go follow Kat at Kat Cole. And until the next time, dream big, because you, my friend, are made for more.